Okay, well, it is Palm Sunday here. We've been talking during Lent here about what it means to follow Jesus in a time when white Christian nationalism is on an upswing of visibility. My hope is that the traditional Palm Sunday story will help us to stitch the last few weeks of teaching together just a little bit here. So we're going to start with the story of Palm Sunday, and the story that unfolds against the backdrop of first century Palestine, when the people of Jerusalem were living under Roman imperial occupation, longing for deliverance from that rule. So I invite you to imagine the scene. It's about a week before Jesus' crucifixion, and he's setting out from a town called Bethany. Bethany's about 2 miles east of Jerusalem. And that town is more than just a waypoint for Jesus. It's actually a place of deep personal connection. He has some dear friends who live there, Mary and Martha and their brother Lazarus, people that he usually would stay with, it seems, when he would go in to Jerusalem for the big festivals. And the air around Bethany there is charged with anticipation because of Jesus' recent miracle of raising Lazarus, his friend, from the dead. And so that has spread like wildfire around the region. It's news that is so exciting, it has left an enduring mark on that town. And to this day, the town is called Al-Lazaria after Lazarus, and it's said that he is buried there. So we picture this journey from Bethany to Jerusalem. And it's a journey that takes us up and over a large hill that's called the Mount of Olives. And then along the way, there are some smaller villages, and one of those is called Bethphage. All right, so we've got Bethany here, Mount of Olives with Bethphage, and then Jerusalem down here. So on his way from Bethany up to the hill, Jesus sends two of his friends ahead of him to find a donkey and a colt. So this is from Matthew 21, if you've got your sermon notes. As they approached Jerusalem and came to Bethphage on the Mount of Olives, Jesus sent two disciples, saying to them, "Go to the village ahead of you, and at once you'll find a donkey tied there with her colt by her. Untie them and bring them to me. If anyone says anything to you, say that the Lord needs them and he'll send them back right away." This took place to fulfill what was spoken through the prophet. "Say to daughter Zion, see your king comes to you, gentle and riding on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey." And the disciples went and did as Jesus had instructed them. And they brought the donkey and the colt, and they placed their cloaks on them for Jesus to sit on. So while this is happening, we can also imagine tens of thousands of pilgrims from all around the region are converging in Jerusalem for this Passover feast. So if you're here in Ann Arbor, it might be like Art Fair Week, or it might be game day, a really big game day for U of M. Right, so the city is buzzing with activity. Jerusalem, there's rumors swirling about this rabbi who has defied death and is now making his way into the holy city. And so crowds are gathering along the roads from Bethphage down to Jerusalem with this expectation and hope that this rabbi might be the one who's come to help free them from Roman rule. Well, Jesus' choice of transportation, we know, was a donkey. And so he's riding into the city from the east, but at the same time, from the west side of the city, the Roman ruler, Pontius Pilate, is also making his way in. He has his own processional from his main residence over in Caesarea Maritima. And so Pilate would always come into Jerusalem for the major feast times. And so as Pontius Pilate is riding in from the west, he's riding in on grand war horses. He's accompanied by a parade of Roman power, including hundreds and hundreds of soldiers. And so while this is happening, Jesus is riding in from the east on the most unmilitary mount imaginable, a female nursing donkey with her little colt running alongside her. I like the picture of that colt. You can just see it sort of, right? So by riding this donkey, Jesus is signaling his commitment to this different way of leading and of influencing. Right, this isn't impressive Roman power with all of the bells and the whistles. It's a power that's grounded in simplicity and humbleness. And it's born out of solidarity with and compassion for the people who are suffering under Roman rule. And so the crowds that surround Jesus, they're connecting with what he stands for, and they're waving these palm branches, which are symbols of resistance against Roman rule. So why were those symbols of resistance? Probably because of their connection to the Jewish festival of Sukkot, right? So during Sukkot, palm branches are used to remember when the Hebrew people were freed from slavery in Egypt. And that connects then that story of a past liberation with this current story of hoped for liberation from the Roman Empire. All right, so as Jesus makes his entrance into Jerusalem, the crowds line the streets. They lay down their cloaks and their palm branches as he passes. And their cries of Hosanna, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, are filling the air. And yet amidst that praise, Jesus is not ignorant of the reality that awaits him in the city. And he weeps for Jerusalem. He laments the city's resistance to this message of peace and reconciliation that he's bringing. Some people are hoping that Jesus is going to go down and start to lead a violent rebellion, or maybe he'll make some kind of power play and become the high priest of the temple. But he's trying to communicate that the kind of revolution that he brings, the kind of revolution that actually ushers in a lasting peace, it doesn't look like that. This is from Luke 19. As Jesus approached Jerusalem and saw the city, he wept over it. And he said, if you, even you, had only known on this day what would bring you peace, but now it's hidden from your eyes. The days will come upon you when your enemies will build an embankment against you and encircle you and hem you in on every side. And they will dash you to the ground, you and the children within your walls, and they will not leave one stone on another because you didn't recognize the time of God's coming to you. Right, so he knows that this land is a volcano that is ready to erupt. And he can see where the events are going to lead if they continue on this same path. And he's not wrong, right? About 40 years later, Rome comes in and completely destroys the city. But Jesus rides in anyway, felt compelled by God to carry this witness of a way of living that is counter to the hierarchies and to the violence of Rome. See, the Roman Empire was at the height of its power in Jesus' day, right? And it had a great marketing strategy. And they used that marketing strategy to promote itself throughout the Mediterranean. There was a clear message that was hammered home through repetitive words and phrases and images. And that message was this: Victorium pace parta terra marique, or is it marique, Christian? Marique? Ah, yeah. Most of my Latin comes from choral singing, so I feel pretty good about it. But, you know, get a little. Basically, victory with peace secured on land and sea, or peace secured by victories on land and sea, and some slight variations, right? So peace through victory, peace through war, peace through military might. And so war was viewed as this productive force through which Rome secured peace. And Jesus lived during this time that you've probably heard of called the Pax Romana, right? Some of you probably studied that in school at some point. And the Pax Romana, the Great Peace of Rome, was this vision of peace for a larger territory of land that made up the Roman Empire, and it was maintained through military might. So we just ignore the fact that there were plenty of skirmishes that were happening during the Pax Romana. The marketing strategy said peace, right? So when Jesus and his followers were pushing back against the Roman Empire, they were presenting a different path for achieving peace. Instead of peace through victory, they presented peace through justice. So for some of you who were here a couple of weeks ago, we looked at that portion of the Sermon on the Mount. Remember the part that talks about turning the other cheek when someone hits you, giving away both cloaks if someone asks you for one, carrying a pack an extra mile. And we were talking about how turning the other cheek was addressing social hierarchies, right? These were ways of talking about creative nonviolent ways of exposing injustice. Right, so people had a right to backhand you if you were their social inferior. And instead, Jesus said, okay, if they backhand you, turn your other cheek. Make them front-hand you as well. Right, so it's saying, look, even if I'm legally your social inferior, if I'm a woman, a slave, a non-Roman citizen, a minority, a child, whatever it is, I demand that you treat me like I'm your equal. Taking off two cloaks, exposed financial injustices, a system where the poor could be driven further and further into debt and destitution. Being forced to carry a pack for a mile by a Roman soldier and then carrying it an extra mile exposed this sort of straight-up oppression of a minority group that was being used for free labor. Right? So peace through justice isn't about letting people walk all over you. It's also not about revenge. Right? Jesus was not about advocating a bloody uprising. Peace through justice is about exposing and transforming unjust social structures so that people can live in prosperity and peace, right? So Rome wanted to tell itself that it upheld this great peace through the use of violence to establish that peace, but Jesus is pointing out that there is no peace even after your violence, Rome. Right? You can use all the violence you want, but there's no real justice for those who are not at the top of Roman society. It's a fake peace. It's the kind of peace that you get when you stand over someone and you have your sword at their throat. Right? They can't move for fear. They're not actually at peace with you because they want to be. They're at peace with you because they have to be. And Rome may have been perfectly okay with that. But Jesus is saying, what if we could make it so that all people felt valued and want to be at peace? And it's idealistic, that idea. It's a little germ of an idea that we call the kingdom of God, that Jesus said, if we could get that, and it could start really small, it could spread through all of humanity like yeast through a ball of dough. And what if the seed of that idea could actually take root today in the 2.4 billion people who call themselves Christian? We might get somewhere. So the heart of Palm Sunday is actually a profound act of protest, right? It's a rejection of the deep story of the Roman Empire, of the Pax Romana, and instead invites people to be driven into an alternative deep story, right? And this alternative story that Jesus offers says that all people deserve respect and dignity. Financial injustices bring shame to communities. Forced labor is a symptom of entitlement and corruption. And true peace can only be achieved when we realize that a right relationship with God demands just relationships with one another. As the book of Ecclesiastes tells us, there's nothing new under the sun. You know, our context here in the United States today is not the same as first century Palestine. There are significant differences. But there are some ways that the two rhyme. Right? The Rome of Jesus's day cared about strict traditional hierarchies, authoritarian rule that often required violence, and boundaries around national identity, right? Who was a Roman citizen? And among those who could actually have much power to vote, to assume office, hint, it was property-owning men. And so if those things sound familiar, it's because they're also the defining characteristics of the white Christian nationalism that we've been talking about that we see in America today. Right, we've been talking about the characteristics that sociologists have used to describe it: adherence to social hierarchies, especially around gender, comfort with authoritarian rule, and the violence that's deemed necessary to maintain peace or control, and then strict boundaries around national identity, right? Who's a real American? So Andrew Seidel, who is a constitutional attorney, he wrote a book called The Founding Myth. And then he's got this kind of long title, but I think it's important to know. He was the expert that wrote the report on Christian nationalism for the United States House of Representatives, the committee that was investigating January 6th. So here's how he describes Christian nationalism. He says, Christian nationalism is an identity that's built on the claim that America was founded as a Christian nation. It was based on Christian principles, and most importantly, that we've strayed from that foundation, from our godly roots. Christian nationalism employs the language of return in an effort to claim to be the true heirs of the American experiment, and more importantly, the American identity. And they're telling Christian nationalists are the true Americans, and everyone else is an interloper. Right? And I think we see this conversation playing out in a lot of different ways. I think a really good example might be, like, Beyoncé's got a new album coming out this week. I don't know how many of you are excited about that. I'm very excited about it. It's called Cowboy Carter. And so it's a country music album, and she's using that genre, and she's using some of the album artwork to challenge who is included in the idea of America. Last week, I thought Caroline did a really nice job acknowledging that just like in all human groups, there's a temptation in religious groups also to close ranks and to try to determine, like, who's really Christian, who's not, who's in, who's out, right? To name enemies, to become more uninclusive and unmoved by harms that are caused by social injustices. And I think when we're taught to do that in our faith communities, it can be easier to either transfer that behavior out or reinforce that kind of behavior in our shared society, right? So we try and practice maintaining this sort of open-handedness with one another in our church spaces. Because I think the energy devoted to the kind of project of determining who's in and who's out just doesn't seem to be what the Jesus movement was about. Right? His energy seemed to be devoted to the messy business of widening the gates, because only God knows who's trying to live a righteous life. Right? So next week, we're going to hold our annual baptisms. We do them once a year. We put up an inflatable hot tub right here, and it's filled with, you know, relatively warm water, kind of lukewarm water. And one of the questions that I very often get from people at Blue Ocean who are wondering about baptism is they usually say, I don't know if I'm Christian enough. Can I still be baptized? I'm not sure if I kind of agree with everything. I'm not sure where I'm at. And so I just want to say that yes, you can be baptized if that's where you're at. Baptism for me is a community ritual, and it signals our intention to do our best to follow this alternative story that is the way of Jesus. Right? So what might that alternative story sound like? I was like, what does baptism mean to me? I thought it sounds something like this. I want God to open my heart to a more expansive love. I want to express hope that there is a God. And if there is a God, then this God is on the side of the oppressed and brings comfort and strength to people in need. I might call that faith. I might say, I want to do my best to heal the disconnections in my relationships with the Creator, with other people, within myself, and with the created order. And to practice forgiveness and reconciliation when it's possible. Right? We might say the old language for that is sin and forgiveness. But the word sin is so loaded with all kinds of other things that I think it's just easier to think about sin as like things that cause disconnection in our relationships. You might say, I want to be a courageous peacemaker in my sphere of influence, and I want to practice peace through justice, not peace through violence or force or coercion. I want to live a life of simplicity and humbleness. I want to follow the Jesus who chose to ride a donkey into Jerusalem, and I want to give generously to those in need rather than embrace cultural symbols of status and power. I want to renounce my right to be a gatekeeper of who is in and who is out, and I want to leave that judging to God. And I want to make a public declaration of this intention with other people who are also doing their best to follow this path. Does that make sense? That's what baptism is to me. That's what it means. And so if that's something that resonates, feel free to talk to me or Caroline after the service. I like to call us equal opportunity baptizers. I know some of you grew up maybe in traditions where you were baptized as babies. If that was meaningful to you, that's meaningful to us. I also do sprinkling and baby baptisms if that's meaningful. I do rebaptisms. So if you're like, you know, gosh, I don't remember my baptism, or it means something different to me now, I'm happy to baptize you for that. We've had several people in the queer community get baptized. Sometimes it's a lovely, I think, communal ritual to sort of acknowledge, like, oh, I hadn't come out yet, and now I am, and I'm able to be fully me before God and my community. That's been really meaningful for many trans congregants as well. And so I'm happy to use the ritual to serve several meanings, if that makes sense, several layers of meanings. And so that's what that is, and I'll look forward to doing that next week. I know we have 3 people so far, so you wouldn't be alone. But if that's helpful, I usually try and talk a little bit about baptism. All right, with that, I invite us, we are going to head into a time here of just silence for about a minute or so. And I know sometimes we're bringing other things in that are going on in our week, and so I just want to make this space for you to be able to just commune with God in whatever way is meaningful to you now. People make noise. I'll let you know when that time is up. As we head into Holy Week, Lord, I ask that you would help us to reflect on the story of of your son and of what he went through, to remember how much courage it took him to stand for this way of living. And I ask that you would imbibe us with that same courage. I ask that you would continue to transform us, that you would help us to understand what it means to follow you, like unfold that in our lives. What does it mean to have peace through justice in our spheres of influence, in our workplaces, in our schools, with our friends? What does it mean to be a peacemaker? What does it mean to live humbly and to live simply and to live generously? What does it mean to stand up for the scapegoated and the outsider? I ask, God, that you would just fill us with your spirit to empower us to learn to do that as best we can. As we enter into your story this week, before coming back together to celebrate the happy ending next week. Amen.